D-I-N-O-L-I-V-E. Oh, I just closed it. Well, let me see if I'm on here. I guess it is. Okay, never mind. So, we're the folks who believe the Bible's true, evolution is dumb, and we defend that against all comers and all callers, et cetera, et cetera. Let me read a few testimonies, make a few announcements, and then we'll get started. Jonathan, we only left about 8 people hanging yesterday.
That's all. That's
a
record, I think.
That's a record. We're trying. Okay.
I'm not trying to leave people behind.
We're not. I mean,
yeah,
I'm
trying to answer the people.
Here's one from Jeremy with a long, long phone number. Must be from New Zealand or something. Ends with the NZ, whatever it is. It says, Dr. Hovind, wow, we absolutely love watching your CSE series. Let me stop there and say that's the video series we do on creation and evolution. We have produced a whole lot of tapes and videos on this topic to present the view that the Earth is about 6,000 years old, like the Bible says. God made it in 6 days. There was a big flood 4,400 years ago that destroyed the planet, rearranged the real estate, created the all the features we see today, like the geology of the Earth. The Grand Canyon probably formed after the flood in a matter of a few weeks or months, stuff like that. So that's all covered on video series, which is 17 hours long, and we cover a whole lot of material on that. Let's see. Anyway, we love watching your CSE series, and we've passed them along and have seen many a confused Christian strengthened in their own faith. My younger brother has been challenging all of his Navy friends about their evolution beliefs. Needless to say, he has less friends now. That's a shame. Shouldn't be that way. But there are several that are interested to know more, so it's awesome. Just reading through the negative testimonies page, I had to laugh at the desperate grasp which people hold on to that theory, but also realized we all need to be praying for these people, too, that the Lord would uncover their blindness. Keep up the awesome work. Glad to see your salt is irritating well. God bless you. From Jeremy in New Zealand. Okay, well, Jeremy, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And do spread it around. That's all we ask people to do, is take the message and spread it to somebody else. Jonathan, I don't see any frowny faces in here. Where are all the atheists?
They're too mad to write, I think.
It's probably cheating looking through the pile here, but so far everybody today loves us. Wow. That's not what we're trying to do. I mean, we're trying to let the Lord love us and trying to do, what he wants. But okay, if you want to instant message us, Dr. Dino Live, D-R-D-I-N-O.
On AOL Instant Messenger.
AOL Instant Message.
We have to say that.
Good. All right. Now, Jonathan, there's something interesting in the news today. Where is that? Let me read another testimony first, and then we'll do the news, and then the announcements, and then get to the questions. Matt writes, I'm a student at Kansas State University. I've seen Dr. Hovind's videos, and they really opened my eyes to the scientific evidence for creation. I've been denied learning in public schools. With the recent State Education Board hearing in Kansas, I'm constantly reminded of how stupid and ignorant I am for disbelieving creation. We need Dr. Hovind to visit so he can share his knowledge and open people's eyes to the truth. Matt. Well, good, Matt. You tell him at Kansas, I'll come take them all on with half my brain tied behind my back, just to make it fair.
Now, if Berkeley won't do it, I wonder if Kansas will.
They won't, Jonathan. These professors want to get in front of their students where they have quite an obvious academic and psychological advantage.
Well, they're grading your paper. Yeah.
Right. And the student, of course, he's afraid of the teacher for fear of losing his grade, which has long-term effects on his, job opportunities the rest of his life, okay? And, he's away from college, and he's got a little bit of peer pressure from all his friends. He wants to fit in with a new group. Nobody wants to stick out like a sore thumb. And the professor has all the degrees behind his name, and there's the wow factor,
Well, there was a Scott Minnick, who's a part of the intelligent design movement. He was giving a lecture on some biochemical, structures. And he was talking about how students in his class are, scared to really, say their mind because they're fearful that he will fail them if they don't agree with him. For instance, he shared one story where he went on a trip with some Indian student that was in his class, and he was sharing his ideas on some, process and some experiments that they were going to do and what he thought the outcome was going to be. And when the Indian student did it, it was different than what his professor thought it was, but the Indian student lied and said that it came out exactly like his professor said it would for, fear that he might get a bad grade. And when Scott Minnick found that out, he said, why are you doing this? You need to tell me the truth, even if I'm wrong. But there are a lot of teachers out there who will not even teachers. There's a lot of school board, you know, authorities that will really come down on your heart if you even mention, you know, criticizing evolution.
Well, I just got today Yahoo News, June 9th at 1 o'clock this afternoon, so 3 hours ago. There's an article called Many Scientists Admit to Misconduct, WashingtonPost.com, by Rick Weiss, Washington Post staff writer. Let me just read some of this. It's rather revealing. And I quote, few scientists fabricate results from scratch or flatly plagiarize the work of others, but a surprising number engage in a troubling degree of fact-bending or deceit. According to the first large-scale survey of scientific misbehavior, more than 5% of scientists answering a confidential questionnaire admitted to having tossed out data because the information contradicted their previous research or said that they had circumvented some human research protections. Let me stop there and add the Hovind comments. These guys, these are the ones who are admitting it, okay, that they had tossed out data that doesn't fit their previous research. This is what happens in evolution all the time. We've had several folks call in the last few days talking about the geologic column, and I forget one of the guys, I asked him, how do you tell a rock is Cambrian? How do you know it's Cambrian? Well, by the index fossils. So if you're digging through rock that you think is Cambrian and you find a human fossil, rather than admit it's, you know, you made a, the whole thing, the whole geologic column is baloney, and humans lived with all through history, and the Bible's right, and the flood formed all those layers, they will never admit that. All they do is say, oh, wow, we were wrong. That's not Cambrian after all. They just reclassify the rock strata. How on earth can you win a debate with people like that, Jonathan? I mean, it's such a rubber theory.
Yeah, definitely.
Makes no sense at all.
Well, it's like Walter Remine said, you know, they have a smorgasbord of alternatives that they can turn to. They can say, they can invoke any type of scientific miracle they wish. He's actually one that coined the whole phrase, or the whole, I guess, description that evolution fits observable data like a fog fits a landscape.
Oh, that was good. The fog and the landscape. That's classic. I like that.
No matter what the observable data is, they will always make a way to explain it with evolution.
Right. If you don't see any evidence, well, that's proof for evolution. If you do see evidence, well, that's proof for evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is proof for evolution. Even the fact that I don't believe in it, well, that's proof for evolution. Their mind, you know.
Yeah.
Let me go on and read this. This is an amazing article. The title again, WashingtonPost.com, is Many Scientists Admit to Misconduct, put out today. It goes on to say, 10% admitted they had inappropriately included their names or those of others as authors on published research reports. You're kidding. There's a research report, so their name ends up on it, and they had nothing to do with it? Or they stick somebody else's name in there to make it look really good? Wow. You know, so-and-so, Professor Smith, is on this one. Ooh, wow. And more than 15% admitted they had changed a study's design or results to satisfy a sponsor or ignored observations because they had a gut feeling they were inaccurate. This is what happened with the modified foods, genetically modified foods, GM. The people who are doing this for Monsanto to sell the modified seeds to make money so that only their seeds will grow on the ground. They have done all sorts of things of modifying the research results, saying, well, you know, this food is perfectly fine. This genetically modified food is fine. They've banned it in Europe. You can see why. I mean, it's dumb. You know, the butterflies, you know, get the pollen off the plants, and the butterflies die. And here they are. They don't care if the people are dying. The butterflies die. Oh, wow, we got to ban it for the butterflies' sake. That's brilliant. Just brilliant. Okay. Now, continue the quote here. None of those failings qualify as outright scientific misconduct under the strict definition used by federal regulators, but they could take at least as large a toll on science as the rare, high-profile cases of clear-cut falsification, said Brian Martinson, an investigator with the Health Partners Research Foundation in Minneapolis, who led the study, appearing in today's issue of the journal Nature. The fraud cases are explosive and can be very damaging to public trust, Martinson said. But these other kinds of things can be more corrosive to science, especially since they're so common. The new survey also hints that much scientific misconduct is the result of frustrations and injustices built into the modern system of scientific rewards. Here we're getting to it, Jonathan. I know what's coming. It starts with an M, okay? Money.
Mm.
All right. Love of money, root of all evil. The findings could have profound implications for efforts to reduce misconduct, demanding more focus on fixing systematic problems and less on identifying and weeding out individual bad apple scientists. Hmm. Are they telling me, Jonathan, that people would falsify their findings just to please the people who sponsored their project?
Oh, certainly not. Science is self-correcting, you know?
You mean guys like Johann or Jonathan, what's the guy who went to Africa and found Lucy?
Johansson, Donald Johansson.
Donald Johansson. Brain went dead for a minute there.
Yeah.
When he went there with grant money to find the missing link and then didn't find it, he had 2 weeks left on his grant money and discovered Lucy. A little suspicious, at least, I would say. I mean, you got to be honest and say that's just a little fishy. Somebody's got 2 weeks left of grant money, and he goes from a nobody to a famous scientist, you know, for finding a chimpanzee bone. Oh, well.
Where the money is.
Look, follow the money. The Yellow Brick Road. That's what that whole movie's about. Did you know that?
Well, all these fossil findings, you see, we never find any mediocre fossil finding today. We just don't hear about these things. It's always every fossil they find, well, we're one step closer to solving the evolutionary, you know, problem here. We're one step closer to fixing this link. And it's always some monumental fossil find. Every time they find anything, they can find a fossil broccoli, and, you know, that's going to be some monumental, you know, thing. It's going to change something, change the way we view the world.
I should have kept articles over the years of every time something comes out in the news that says, this new find will force us to rethink all of evolution theory. You know, there have been thousands of those published. Somebody wants a good project, but go back and research the archives and find articles that said, you know, we're going to have to rethink the theory, or, you know, this sheds doubt on the family tree, or all the times. They've had to rethink this theory 400 times, and they still haven't got it right. Of course, now, in their mind, even that is proof for evolution.
Yeah, that's just, to them, I guess it's more of a refining process.
Oh, yeah, self-correcting. See, we change our mistakes. You Christians don't change yours.
We don't need to.
We don't need to.
But,
I mean,
we do have a pretty big controversy even in the creation realms. We have the big debates over, you know, geology stuff. We have the basic idea of what the Bible said is true, and there are debates, scientific debates, about how things may have happened. And so, I mean, even that statement that we just have all the answers right up front is not the case. There are many lively debates within the creationist circles as well.
Right, but you know, some things just don't need to be analyzed over and over, like 2 plus 2 is 4. I mean, let's go on and learn some more math. Okay?
Well, there's no truth. There's no absolute. So that may need to be, you know, analyzed over.
So it might be like 4.1 or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah. 2 what? You know, what do you really mean by 2?
Right, and what do you mean plus? What do you mean equal?
How do I know you're even here?
That's right. Why are we having this discussion?
Are we having this discussion?
That's right. All right, folks, join the program if you want to write to us. AOL instant messages at Dr. Dino Live, DrDinoLive. Or you can call us at 850-479-3466. 850-479-3466. Go to extension 136. I'm reading an article here from WashingtonPost.com today, 1 o'clock, June 9th of 2005, about dishonesty. Many scientists admit to misconduct. This is fascinating. Just a little bit more, John, and we'll start taking instant messages.
I'd at least like to give these scientists a pat on the back for coming out and showing the true colors.
But now, watch what's going to happen. Rick Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, who wrote this, will be selling apples tomorrow. He'll be fired. You don't dare expose that evolution is a lie or that the king hath no clothes. You just don't dare do that and keep your job. I mean, there's a real... This evolution religion is carefully protected.
Well, they've adopted the first of the Ten Commandments, you know, have no other gods before me. And so these ardent evolutionists view evolution as their god. And if you even question that, it'd be much like someone, you know, questioning, is Christ really the Messiah? That's going to make me a little upset. You know, they've adopted the first of the Ten Commandments and have no other gods before evolution in their own mindset.
Oh, good way to put it. Okay, they go on to say, scientific dishonesty has long been a simmering concern. Many suspect, for example, that Gregor Mendel, the Austrian monk whose plant breeding experiments revealed with suspicious precision the basic laws of genetics, cooked his numbers along with his peas. No, you're kidding. Catholic priest is going to lie? Maybe so. Says, in recent decades, a handful of cases have risen to the level of popular attention, the most famous, perhaps, involving David Baltimore, the Nobel laureate who in the mid-1980s heated lead no breakdown. We'll be back, folks, right after the break. Get your questions in to Dr. Dino Live.
One of the greatest helpers for Truth Radio in the past has been those of you who have signed up for Lifeline telephone service, long-distance service, local service, internet service, and now the Lifeline company, Lifeline Communications, is offering service through T-Mobile. If you have a cell phone or if you would like to have a cell phone service that really works and has really modern, neat equipment and a great approach to this whole business of cell phone, and you want to help Truth Radio at the same time, then may I recommend that you call 800, that's 800-311-2418, that's 800-311-2418. And tell them that you want to sign up for T-Mobile through Lifeline. Phone 1-800-311-2418. Your participation with Lifeline will help Truth Radio.
Old ideas and not outdated. Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Apologetics Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, in today's culture, people often consider old things to be outdated or wrong, especially books. Now, is there a problem with that viewpoint?
Well, think about this. Archbishop Usher lived in the 1600s. Other than the Bible, I believe his famous book, The Annals of the World, is the best book of history ever written. He accepted everything the Bible says, and when he added up all of its dates, he reached the date of 4004 BC for creation. Today, people mock Usher, but if we add up the dates as Usher did, we get the same basic date anyway. So the problem's not with Usher. He was a respected scholar who used the very best historical documents available. Usher did the right thing. He started by believing what the Bible says. He didn't accept man's popular views of history based on fallible assumptions. He didn't claim to be perfect, but he did accept the Bible's claim to be perfect, true and unchanging, regardless of its age. Ideas aren't right or wrong based on how old they are. They're right or wrong based on how closely they match God's Word, beginning right there with the book of Genesis.
God's Word is a true history book. In fact, in Ken's brand new booklet, he summarizes the history of the world in the seven C's of history. Some fascinating reading is available free when you go to our attractive website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
All right, welcome back to the Creation Science Hour. This is Jonathan Sampson here this June 9th here in Pensacola, Florida with Dr. Kent Hovind. We're at Creation Science Evangelism. You guys can go ahead and send your messages right now to Dr. Hovind, or actually to myself, and I'll forward them to Dr. Hovind over AOL Instant Messenger, AOL Instant Messenger, to the screen name Dr. Dino Live, D-R-D-I-N-O-L-I-V-E, and that will go directly to me, where it will eventually find its way onto the desktop of Dr. Ken Hovind. Is one of the most requested speakers on creation, evolution, dinosaurs, and the Bible. And I got him sitting right here, beside me.
And one of the most hated men on the internet, too, Jonathan.
One of the most loved, as well.
And one of the most loved, yeah.
He managed to pull off both the screens.
We're not trying to do either one of those, but, hey, that's the way it works, okay? All right, let's see. We were reading about the many scientists admit to misconduct. In recent debates, I'm quoting here from WashingtonPost.com today, June 9th of 2005, in recent debates, a handful of cases have risen to the level of popular attention, the famous being David Baltimore, the Nobel laureate who in the mid-80s heatedly defended his laboratory's honor in a series of scathing congressional hearings led by Representative John Dingell, Democrat from Michigan. The prevalence of research misconduct has been uncertain, however, in part because the definitions of acceptable behavior have shifted. They're evolving. For scientists working with federal grant money, the issue got settled 5 years ago when the Office of Research Integrity, part of the Department of Health and Human Services, drafted a formal definition, quote, fabrication, falsification, or plagiarism in proposing, performing, or reviewing research or in reporting research results, end quote. About a dozen federally funded scientists a year are found to have breached that FFP standard, a tiny fraction of the scientific workforce, and punishment generally involves a ban on further federal grants. But no one has conducted a major survey asking scientists whether they are guilty of major misconduct or lesser, but arguably still serious, ethical lapses.
Even if they did, I wonder how many scientists would put their jobs, their lives, their families, income, everything on the line just to say, yeah, I lie.
Here's what happens. If you do scientific research and it comes out not supporting the evolution theory, you will lose your grant money.
Kind of like a few guys you're actually, you know, personally.
Well, the guy who did, you know, Halos.com, Robert Gentry, his research was pointing clearly to the fact that the Earth was never a hot molten mass.
Published in peer review, got my tongue tangled up, my words wixed, peer-reviewed journals.
Yep, yeah, and so they shut him off like a spigot when they found out, wow, this guy's going to prove our theories wrong. Yep, it sure does. And anything you do, like Roy Mackle, when he got his did his research on dinosaurs still living, here he is, University of Chicago, biology teacher.
He's not even a Christian, is he?
No, not even a Christian. He believes in evolution. But he heard all these rumors about dinosaurs living in Africa, so he did the logical thing a scientist ought to do and said, let's go check it out. So he goes over to Africa, spends 2 weeks, comes back and says, man, there is incredible stuff here. I better come back. He goes back and spends $250,000 on a couple-of-month expedition. After 2 trips to Africa, he comes back and writes a book called Living Dinosaur, available on our website, drdino.com. Here he is, University of Chicago biology professor, writes this book. Then nobody in America would publish it because they said, we don't want American scientist publishing a book saying dinosaurs might still be alive. That goes against the theory, for heaven's sake.
That's kind of how it was with a way off topic here, but Star Wars, when George Lucas got the brilliant idea for Star Wars, nobody wanted to even touch it. They thought it sounded ridiculous. And when somebody finally helped him put that word out, it exploded. And it's kind of like the creation thing. If somebody just gets that word out, going to explode. I mean, people can just see that there's so much truth and, you know, examining evolution a bit more closely and looking at the Bible in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So, finally, he published a book in the Netherlands, and we get it from there and sell it. But it's sad, you know, that if something, we have a couple callers call in, you know, and I try to pin them down to make them admit if something doesn't fit their theory, it's not science. It can only be science if it fits the theory. What a dumb way to run your life. But, okay, instant messages, folks, quick, at Dr. Dino Live, DrDinoLive, or you can call us at 850-479-DINO and get ahead of the pile. And we will have to limit the call since we get so many people want to be on the program to probably just, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And if it gets out of hand, we'll have to, you know, enforce a limit there. Okay, here we go. FishOC16 writes in, yesterday I told you about the show on the Venus, and I looked on the Internet and found the name of it. It was on the Science Channel. It's called The Enigma of Venus, and the series is called Cosmic Odyssey. I think I saw it May 25th, 05 at 3 p.m. I'm 90% sure it's the show, but I'll keep looking for it. God bless. Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. The purpose of that note was to say that Venus does not have many craters, I believe, if I recall, and therefore it only had a few thousand years' worth of meteor impact strikes, indicating Venus. Of course, to me, it would indicate Venus is not, you know, millions of years old. Why don't they see that, Jonathan? Am I the only one?
I don't think they're really open for that.
Willingly ignorant.
Dumb on purpose.
Dumb on purpose is correct. Okay. Here we go. Lieutenant Junior Chaos writes, I'm a student at Crown College of the Bible in Powell, Tennessee. Hey, man, I've been there a couple times. Good school.
You're going to Knoxville, actually, tonight.
I'm going there tonight.
Yeah,
that's right. I'll be speaking there tomorrow afternoon. If you want to come over, let's see. I'll be at a Professional Educators of Tennessee meeting tomorrow afternoon. And then tomorrow night at the church is on the way to the airport, south of Knoxville. Let's see. Sevier Heights Baptist Church.
Sevier Heights.
Sevier Heights.
Sounds dangerous.
It does, doesn't it? Sevierville, Tennessee, I believe, is the name of the town is named after. But
you got to drive 6 hours uphill and go to church on the edge of a cliff or something? Or what is that?
Right, yeah, Sevier Heights. You got it, Jonathan. Yeah, good. We're leaving tonight. Going to drive partway tonight and then drive the rest of the way tomorrow since it's a long drive. But it will be up there in Knoxville. So come on over if you get a chance. Okay, go on, read the question here. I don't get your broadcast way out here that I know of, but I've seen all your videos. Is there a way I can listen to your show from here? Yes, you can. You can do it right on the Internet. Can't they just... Is it, not to be, is it live streaming, or what's it called, Jonathan?
Yeah, it's streaming live right now, truthradio.com.
They can do it off our website, too?
Well, Truth Radio, they can, but Truth Radio has several different options for different types of connections, which will suit different types of people. So they will get a much broader broader decision, you know, smorgasbord of decisions at truthradio.com.
So it depends what kind of phone system they have, what kind of dial-up and all that, right?
Everything.
So if they have the one where they pick it up and say, Sarah, would you get me Aunt B? Then they probably need to go to Truth Radio. Okay. And there are parts of Tennessee that still have that, by the way. I've been there. Okay. Do you have stream live stream? Do you live stream your broadcasts? Yes, we do. You have to replay back on here, though, because I obviously can't hear you at the moment. Oh, well. How can I fix that, Jonathan?
Talk really loud.
Talk loud. So they can hear me in Tennessee. Well, I'll do that tomorrow. Okay, here we go. England, Canada, 999, writes in. I found this rebuttal to Jonathan Sarfati's, there we go, comments concerning increasing genetic information. I was wondering what you thought. Sarfati caps off his unscientific explanation with the old canard about the sorting and loss of genetic information. What creationists don't understand or choose not to understand is that instances of increases in DNA information have been documented. For instance, there's an obvious increase in information when a gene duplicates and the two copies undergo independent mutations, which result in two genes with somewhat different functions. Despite the fact that gene duplication, mutation, and selection are known to occur due to natural biochemical processes in a variety of organisms studied in the laboratory, creationists deny that the expansion from a single primordial gene to a large family of genes with distinct functions clearly represents an increase in genetic information. Okay. Polyploidy, the doubling of information, the doubling of the gene code, is not new information. Okay, that much I think we can agree on. Let's suppose an organism, like a possum, has 22 chromosomes. So they double the number of chromosomes. Now they have 44. Okay? What this person is saying apparently is, well, now that you have 44 chromosomes, you have more information to work with. And so mutations might be able to rescramble them and combine and get some new combinations. The problem is not that you need more information in order to scramble. The problem is the scrambling process itself is negative. If you have two books and I want you to rescramble the letters and make a whole new book out of it, okay, that'd be tough, but if I give you two books or four books or 10 books and you rescramble it, it's not going to, it's the same information. We'll be back, folks, right after the break. Hang in there.
Doreen May, I'm going to do something real big for God.
You're finally going to go next door and talk to Andy?
Nope. Picture a 360-foot statue of Jesus in our backyard with a fish in one hand and a loaf of French bread in the other.
That's nice, Stu Bob.
Where's that sack of cement I had?
You mean the one you bought to engrave the entire Bible on?
Yeah, that's right.
It's next to the paint you were going to use for the mural of the Last Supper.
You don't think I'm going to do this, do you?
Stu Bob, every time you get inspired, you want to do something so big that you just can't do it.
Well, these things take time.
Why don't you start by talking to Andy?
I don't want to touch just one person. I want to touch thousands.
No, you don't. You want to do anything you can but talk to your neighbor.
I know. I'll make Christian radio messages and play them on the radio.
That still ain't talking to your neighbor. Will you go next door?
A message from Lifeline Productions. 1-800-52-FUNNY at lifelinepro.com.
for listening to Truth Radio. Our address is Post Office Box 344, Nipomo, California. That's Post Office Box 344, N-I-P-O-M-O, Nipomo, California, 93444. Write to us.
The horror of 9/11 stands out in our minds, and most of us, certainly most of the people you talk to from day to day, think immediately after they think about the horror of that day about those Arab terrorists who did the job. Well, I have a book here written by Victor Thorne. It's called 9/11 on Trial. This book is so important, I am sending it to known Truth Radio listeners, a book or two each day, because I want you to have this book, but it's going to take me perhaps more than a year to get the job done. If you'd like your copy of the book ahead of time, please let me know. A small donation to Truth Radio will bring it to you. P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, 93444. Ask for the 911 book.
Yep, all right, welcome back to the Creation Science Hour. This is, once again, June 9th, and this is Dr. Ken Hovind and Jonathan Sampson here in Pensacola, Florida, Creation Science Evangelism. And we're ready to take the questions from the evolutionists and get them all converted.
Let the converting commence.
Okay. All right, let's see. We're reading questions here that people have sent to us by AOL Instant Message, Dr. Dino Live, D-R-D-I-N-O-L-I-V-E, or call us if you'd like to get ahead of the pile, 850-479-3466, extension 136. Okay, we were talking about the genetic information. Jonathan Sarfati had written an article about, polyploidy, doubling the chromosome information is not increasing genetic complexity. What this person is telling you is, if you doubled the number of chromosomes, which is an exact copy of what you already have, and then you scramble it, you're more likely to possibly get a genetic combination that is increasing. Well, it sounds good theoretically. There are no known examples of it happening, okay? And so it's not really science to say it happens. What they're doing now is appealing to philosophically, well, it could happen, you know, maybe, don't you see? But see, doubling existing information is not going to solve their problem. You've already got quite a complex gene code. Just scrambling that doesn't do it. Why would scrambling twice the gene code do it? No difference at all. So tell them, I disagree. There are no examples of it happening. What they've got still is a religion saying they believe it happened. Great, go for it. I don't care about your religion. Where's the science? Okay, Martin from Sweden on the phone. Let's see. Okay.
Yep.
Yes,
hi,
Martin.
Ken.
Hello, you're up kind of late over there.
Yeah, it's a little late. Sorry, I'm getting this strange feedback sound.
Okay, we had our speaker up too loud. I think you should be better now.
Okay, cool. Polyploidy.
Okay.
Polyploidy is a doubling of the total number of chromosomes, or a multiplication of the number of chromosomes.
That's more than that.
No, that's what it is. That's
no,
what
it's
defined
no,
as.
No, it's more than that. It is a doubling, not just a doubling of the number of chromosomes, it's an exact copy of the very same information.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, right.
That's a duplication.
Right.
Of the whole, of the chromosomes. So that's not the same as a gene duplication.
Well, each whole chromosome is duplicated.
Yes, but there's often cases where an individual gene can be duplicated, and that's different from, that's not polyploidy at all.
Okay, correct, but even duplicating an individual gene is still the same information twice.
That's right, but suppose we have a bacterium that normally lives on something like glucose, and then we put it in a solution of partial glucose and partial fucose. And fucose is something that normally bacteria don't grow on.
Okay.
And as bacteria grow in this solution, they start to use up the glucose.
Sure.
But then we find that all of a sudden the bacteria don't die once the glucose is used up. But what happens is they start to use fucose. Okay.
Right.
How does this happen?
They were starving to death.
Yes. They were starving to death because they didn't have they didn't have a sugar substrate to survive on, but now they seem to be using fucose. Now, how did this happen?
Which is simply another type of sugar.
Yep.
Okay. Now, you think that process you just described is sufficient?
No, no. I'm asking you how you think this happened, if you have any information about how this happened.
I don't, actually. No, I've heard of this before, and that's not the type of thing I study normally.
I know, because normally you don't study biology. The thing is, we know what happens. If they start using their normal glucose-synthesizing genes to process fucose, okay, and then we notice that the rate at which they process fucose suddenly doubles. Why? Because they duplicate the gene, and that they can survive on fucose twice as well now. And more, as time progresses, they can actually live on fucose almost as efficiently as they lived on glucose.
Now, are these still single-celled bacteria?
And the point is, a gene duplication can occur, and it can provide new information. I don't care. It's not going to turn into a chicken overnight, and this has nothing to do with that.
It has everything to do with it, because this is what you're using as evidence for that belief.
No, actually. The evidence for that has nothing to do with whether or not, genes can duplicate. Well, actually, it has a lot to do with it, but not whether or not, what you're saying is just completely false. I mean, that's the real problem. Your evidence against evolution is often completely false, and people can find examples where gene duplication actually does occur and does increase the amount of information.
Well, wait,
I don't provide
it. No, you're not going to slip this one past me.
I know.
You're saying this process of you doubled the genes, and it allowed it to eat a new thing and survive.
Yeah.
That process is going to that is one.
I didn't say that process. See, this is the thing. I'm not saying that doubling a gene for processing glucose is going to turn the bacterium into a chicken. Okay? That's not what I'm saying.
What I'm saying is
that gene duplications do have a selective advantage.
Okay, so suppose the original bacterium was capable of digesting both, and what we have today is a degenerative form. So the evidence you gave is just as much evidence for creation.
No, it's not at all. I mean, what are you talking about, a degenerative form?
Well, suppose the bacterium now that lives on glucose was originally capable of living on both, but it lost...
But it wasn't.
Well, so I don't know that. But it lost a function like we lost the function to produce vitamin C.
Right. So that had to come back through a mutation. And either way, if it was lost in the past, but it had to come back somehow.
But where did
it came back through mutation.
Where did it start? How did it get this ability to eat glucose or fructose?
This is totally irrelevant because we're talking about how you actually go from something that exists, which is a life form, and change it into being able to do something else.
You're talking about a change in its diet, for heaven's sake, and it's still a single-celled organism.
It's more than a change in its diet. It's a change in the genetic structure and a change in the actual metabolic processes that's brought about by duplicating information in the genome.
And, but see, you're missing the whole point, though. This is still a bacterium.
It's still a bacterium. I'm not going to argue that changing the glucose metabolism genes is going to change it into anything else.
That's what you're trying to imply.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Where did I say this? When did I say this?
Okay. Is that the best evidence you know of that would support the idea that an organism can change to a different kind of organism?
Well, because you can't really seem to define what a kind is. Then I'll say, no, it's not the best evidence I can find. Okay, it has obviously changed into a different kind of organism. It is the type of bacterium that did not exist before.
Yeah, it's on. You just made an accusation and said he never defined what a kind is, and then you blew right past it. Why don't you ask him what a kind is?
I have defined it many times. You're not listening.
Okay.
Don't tell me I haven't defined it.
Okay.
A kind is those that originally were able to bring forth.
Yeah.
There you go. I defined it.
That's not really a definition. That's not an empirically tractable definition. How do we determine that?
What's the definition of species?
There are a number of actual species concepts that are defined, but that was a term that was also created by a creationist.
I don't know who created it.
Linnaeus started it.
Sure. But
yeah,
the fact
and he was a creationist because he believed that, that these species were immutable things. But the discovery of evolutionary biology is not the discovery of species, but the discovery that species boundaries are indefinite.
You blew right past it, man. He just asked you what a species was, and you blew right past it.
I don't know exactly what a species was.
Well, there you go.
That's the problem, because this is what Darwin discovered. Darwin is not the person who proposed the term species.
We're not talking about
Darwin. Darwin is the person who proposed that there's a problem with defining species, and this has to do with evolution.
There's not a problem with defining kind, and I've defined it many times, and yet you accuse me of not defining it, so I don't understand.
I don't find that a satisfactory definition, because it doesn't give us... Okay, let's take the biological species definition. Okay, it has its problems. I'm not saying that this is what a species necessarily is, but somebody says, a species is a population of organisms that has the capacity to interbreed, right?
So why are dog and wolf different species?
No, exactly. I'm not defending this view, but what I'm saying is exactly what you're going to say. Well, why can a dog and a wolf interbreed? According to that definition, then dog and wolf ought to be the same species, right?
Right.
Exactly. That is an empirically tractable definition. We can change that species term because we have a strong enough definition to actually go out and test it, actually to employ it empirically. Kind, here's my definition of a kind. It's the boundary drawn wherever creationists would like evolution to stop.
I've got a really great idea here.
Yes.
So you can actually go out and you can test whether or not a dog and a wolf should be the same species, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Hold on a second.
How would we debate, you know, all these ancient creatures, ancient, put quotes around that, all these ancient creatures that we're finding that they're given names of species and stuff too, how do they find out if these things are infertile?
Oh, that's a problem. You can't.
So we can never know if, you know, what they say the species is really that species.
Not according to the biological species definition.
Why are they giving these things species names?
What's that?
I don't know.
It doesn't have to do with the biological species definition at all. And yeah, it is to a large extent. Species boundaries are in the fossil record are quite arbitrary because it has to do with the fact that limited sort of variable sets are defined.
Morphological
species,
features or something.
Yeah. It's all entirely on morphology because that's all you have with fossils.
So whenever someone says something like Neanderthal and humans weren't exactly the same. You know, there are different subsets and stuff like that.
Yep.
That argument there really has no credibility.
What it lacks credibility in saying is anything about reproductive compatibility because there's no evidence of reproductive compatibility. The problem would be if somebody did try to make that claim because we have no evidence for that. But if you can define, say, for instance, you know how... Dr. Obon, you cite Charles Ochsner's study.
Yes, sir.
Of Lucy.
Yes, sir.
Right. So there he provided a morphometric analysis defining a set of variation, which you would agree allows him to interpret this thing as more like a chimpanzee than something else, right?
Allowed him to interpret this thing as what?
As more like a chimpanzee than like a human being.
Correct.
Right. You can do the same thing with Neanderthals to clump them together using morphometric analyses, okay? And that's all it allows us to do, and we name that morphometric clump Homo Neanderthalensis, and that's it. I mean, it's not saying that anything about reproductive compatibility.
Well, that
it's
was just
naming
that's a side tangent that I came up just out of interest. You know.
Well, I'm still curious now what a species is because...
I mean, a lot of people are curious about what a species is, and there are entire journals and research fields dedicated to
it. Okay, but if you don't have a good definition of species, then how do you know evolution has happened? You talk about speciation.
I know they talk about speciation, and again, it's the same kind of thing. If we choose an empirical definition and we want to determine when reproductive boundaries originate, then we can, because that's properly defined enough, study this in a population.
So speciation is basically supported by semi-flexible arbitrary tagging of whatever.
No, it's not actually arbitrary or semi-flexible.
No, I know that,
When you set up a definition, of what you're setting out to show, like reproductive isolation,
mm-hmm.
then you have, like, you have something that you can actually, that is so well defined, and you set out the parameters for what you want to show, and then you go out and test that.
Well, I agree. I agree that speciation occurs. I'm just, you know, trying to figure out what you're saying here. So.
Okay, which part?
Well, I agree speciation occurs, too. I don't think anybody argues with that, because that's
what
Hugh Ross argues with that, actually.
Well, who's that?
Yeah, Hugh Ross, the
Yeah.
Speciation is a fluid term, number one.
Well,
number two, that's totally beside the point. We're still talking about the same kind of animal.
Yep.
I mean, a five-year-old would tell you it's the same kind of animal. You don't need to be a PhD biology to figure out that a dog and a wolf are the same kind of animal.
Yeah, but you know your little trick with the... where you take a kid out of the audience and you show them a banana, a dog, and a wolf?
Yes.
I've done the same trick, actually, with a banana, a turtle, and a wolf.
Uh-huh.
And when asked which are the same kind, of course, the same child will respond that the turtle and the wolf are the same kind.
Well, see, there you're tricking the child by the question.
You're tricking the child by the question, too.
When
you say kind and you use an ill-defined term, then you leave it up to the person looking at the subject matter to define kind ostensibly.
What is so ill-defined about two creatures that can bring forth?
Yeah, but he's not talking about that. He shows them a picture of a wolf, a dog, and a banana, and asks them to find which are the same kind.
Well, yeah,
it's pretty obvious that the child is going to group them by general similarities.
But and even in your question with the turtle, the banana, and the wolf, they're going to classify the turtle and the wolf as living animals and the banana as a living plant. So they're still getting it right. But
that's my point, Kent.
But they're not infertile. None of those are.
No, but the child isn't discriminating into fertility either. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
All right, well, that's 15 minutes. We got to go. We got to
go. All right, well, have a good night, Kent.
All right, thanks a lot.
Cheers.
All right, folks, if you want to call me on the program, 850-479-DINO, 850-479-3466, extension 136.
I found an article on Answers in Genesis about that, I guess, the situation earlier with Johnson's Rafati and the parents are alleged rebuttal to his discussion on gene duplication. There's one by a botanist called Alexander Williams on Answers in Genesis called Copy and Confusion. The duplication of existing DNA helps. So there's a bit more of a thorough discussion on that for anyone who wants it.
Yeah, copying and making typographical errors as you copy is not going to be a pattern, not going to be not going to supply the data you need to change a rock to a human over any number of bazillion years. Okay, it's not going to work. So they can believe that if they want, and I do admire their faith. I mean, I wish they would just admit it's a faith and a religion, okay? And all right, here we go. What did I read about? We did that one. Okay, God's Creation, 1865. I read about how one of the cavemen was built up from a tooth. I'm convinced that these people thought it was a caveman. They shouldn't be a scientist. But they should work for the FBI. Think about how valuable they would be. They would say, okay, here's a tooth. I'd say the suspect is 6'2", 200 pounds, and has a tattoo on his left elbow. Has a wife who is a vegetarian, has three kids, all in college now, is blind in one eye, and walks slightly bent over. Here, let me draw him for you. Good point, God's Creation. I think it was a John Wayne movie where this Indian saw these footprints and said, oh, yeah, the guy's six foot tall and weighs 185 and has 45 cents in his pocket, you know, or something like that. Pretty good from a footprint. You know, it is amazing how much data they can draw from one little thing. That's why, like the thing with genetic gene duplication or chromosome duplication, they are so desperate for evidence for their theory that any little thing like that, that even hints it might be helping the theory, wow, they jump all over it and paint a big bow on it. Everybody look at this, you know. Wow. Okay. And the guys that spend all their time digging in the dirt looking for rocks, you know, Jonathan, they have to make a big deal out of it when they find something.
It's completely, I mean, I don't mean to sound harsh on, you know, paleoanthropologists and people like that who try looking for these human fossils, but it's completely, to me, it's a waste of time. Who cares if we find old bones? I mean, it's kind of neat, yeah, but it's really useless. You know, to my understanding here, maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems useless to me.
Well, we got all these millions of dollars being spent on building these big buildings to house these bones and to air condition them
and to build fancy cases around it. I mean, Al Gore ought to be upset about the money they're wasting on all the trees they're cutting down, you know, to save these bones. They should have left them in the dirt. They were doing fine.
I mean, look at, you know, all this money that we, I just remember, you know, this last little trip they're going to be making to NASA, or this trip they're going to be making to the moon. They're going to spend billions of dollars to fly up there and play around on this rock. I mean, we've got people all over the world starving and dying.
Yeah. All right, folks, we'll be back after the break. Get your questions in to Dr. Dino Live.
Somewhere down deep in the resources of Truth Radio, a video has been hiding, and I just discovered it recently. It's entitled The Civil War Debate. This is a public meeting with hundreds of people attending. It was held, I believe, in Georgia. There is one man stating the case for the North and another man stating the case for the South and a moderator. It's anything but boring. If you've studied our history going back to the Civil War at all, there's information in this video that you will consider to be really vital, and it's a really terrific experience to listen to it. I hope you'll order a copy as you write to P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444. Your gift of any size will bring you a copy of The Civil War Debate. Write to us soon. Thanks.
The 2-1 pitch from Mallory. Curveball, strike two.
When right, throws you a curve.
Bottom of the third, here's the 2-2 fastball. Hit deep to center.
Hit a home run. Here's Rise Above with Rob Rosenblum.
I've seen you in your sanctuary and gazed upon your power and glory. Your unfailing love is better to me than life itself. How I praise you. I will honor you as long as I live, lifting up my hands to you in prayer. When's the last time you fell to your knees and praised God? Praised Him for His grace, for His mercy, for His love. Let everything that has breath praise the Lord. As Mac Powell, the lead singer of Third Day, said, from the very beginning, praise and worship has always been a huge part of who we are and what we do. Rise above and praise the Lord.
Rise Above with Rob Rosenblum is a production of Rise Ministries at RiseMinistries.com and is made possible by Northwestern College, a distinctly Christian liberal arts college in Orange City, Iowa. Visit nwciowa.edu.
Welcome back to the Creation Science Hour. This is Jonathan Sampson and Dr. Ken Hovind here June 9th in Pensacola, Florida. Are you still with us?
Yes, sir.
All right.
We're here. June 9th. If you want to call in, be on the program, 850-479-DINO, extension 136, or instant message, Dr. Dino Live. And if you go to truthradio.com, you can pick it up all sorts of different ways, get the program, you know, upside down, backwards and forwards.
We got to tell them it's AOL Instant Messenger.
AOL, because
yeah.
There's all kinds of instant messengers out
tons
there.
Tons and tons of those.
Really? Okay. I don't know or care about any of that stuff, Jonathan. That's fine with me. Here we go. She Makes Me Shiver writes in. Question number one. How do we know that the years in the Bible are 365-day years? When did man establish that calendar? The Gregorian calendar that we use today was, I think, established about 800 years ago. I don't know the details, but you know, it's just been in the last few centuries. There are quite a few different calendars used down through history. The Mayans had one. Actually, some of the calendars are actually more accurate than ours. We have a day that is 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 48 seconds, or something similar to that, is the length of a day. Not exactly 24 hours. And the number of revolutions the Earth makes while it is going around the sun one time is 365.2422. So it works out about 365 and a quarter, but it's not exactly a quarter. That's why you have a leap year every 4 years, but on the 100-year anniversary, you don't. And even then, they got to make up for it. On the 400-year anniversary, every 400 years, they do have it or something like that. There's a long, complicated formula to calculate when leap years are to keep the calendar straight, and even then, it gets messed up a little bit. So, I think the Bible dates, though, I mean, the number of days you have per month or the number of days you have per year varies from, you know, culture to culture.
The Jewish calendar says this is year 5700 and something.
Right.
Yeah.
This is 5765, I think, on the Hebrew calendar, but it's interesting. Some Jewish rabbi, hundreds of years ago, maybe even several thousand years ago, purposely left out, couldn't be 2,000 years ago, but a long time ago, he left out a couple of 150 or 60 years, purposely so the prophecy in Daniel would not point to Jesus Christ being the Messiah. We cover all that on Seminar Part 1, if you want to get that. You find that interesting? Okay, so the calendar we use today is fairly recent, you know, last few hundred years, maybe 1,000 years. Pope Gregory, whenever he lived, maybe somebody can look up the date on that, the Gregorian calendar. So you're right, but that wouldn't change the number of how long a year was. I mean, a year is, you know, springtime to springtime, or summer to summer, or winter to winter. How many days are during that interval? It kind of doesn't matter. You know, if the Earth was spinning a whole lot faster, we'd still have, you know, summer to summer, it would still be the same amount of time, just more days per year that way. Here we go. She makes me shiver. Question number two. If the word let used to mean the opposite of its current meaning, is that in Genesis accurate? I believe Genesis and the whole Bible to be true, but this is what an evolutionist would argue. I don't understand that comment, question. In Romans, I think it's Romans chapter 1, Paul was talking to him. He said, I would have come to you, but I was let hitherto. The word let has had several meanings down through history, and even today probably has several meanings. And Bill Clinton was right. I mean, the word is has quite a few different definitions also. But the word for, instance, has another good example. For has several definitions, F-O-R. This is where Church of Christ people get all bent out of shape because they quote Acts 2:38 and says, repent and be baptized for the remission of sins. You say, oh, see, you have to get baptized and the water washes away your sin. Wait. If I said, John is in jail for stealing cars, what does the word for mean in that sentence?
Because of.
He is in jail for stealing cars, okay? He's not in there to learn how to do it. Okay, he's in there because he already did it. So it's referring to a past event. The word for would have multiple meanings, and you would, before you could interpret Acts 2:38, you would have to see how that applies to other verses of the Bible. If baptism is really part of salvation, you have a problem because it's not mentioned every place salvation is mentioned. Salvation is mentioned a lot of places, and it doesn't mention baptism, so there you got a real serious problem, I think. Of course, you got the thief on the cross, obviously, could not be baptized. And how can something one man does to another person, i.e. baptize them, how can that be part of God's salvation? That sounds Catholic to me. You're trying to involve man in God's procedure here. So, I don't buy it. The question was, the word for, or the word let, is there a specific verse you're referring to here in Genesis where the word let?
Talking about, you know, when let the earth bring forth grass.
Okay, let
stuff.
There be light, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I guess I need to clarify it and say the word let in Romans, you know, Paul said, I would have come to you, but was let hitherto. I should say the word let used to have additional meanings. That's not what it always meant, as in today the word for has multiple meanings. The word to, T-O, has multiple meanings. Look it up in a dictionary. So the word let had multiple meanings. One of the meanings back then was to hinder. So I don't know that that necessarily is what it meant in Genesis. I didn't mean to imply that was the only definition of the word. That's just one of the definitions they had back then. Okay.
Well, you know, in Genesis, if God was really saying, you know, he's hindering the earth from bringing forth grass, he's going to hinder the, you know, the light from coming forth, you know, then at the end he would have nothing to look at and say it's very good. If that really meant don't let it, you know, if that's what he meant by let, is don't let, you know, the earth bring forth grass and herb yielding
good
seeds.
Good point.
He wouldn't have anything to look at, if that's what the definition was for that story right there.
Okay. There you have it, straight from the horse's mouth. Here we go.
Not a horse.
Okay. She makes me shiver. Comment or input? Third question here, or whatever. I would like to point out something to everyone, including Dr. Hovind, about the 1950 virus that was recently on the news. According to Georgia Guidestones, the world population needs to stay below 500 million. On one of Dr. Hovind's seminars, he says that the government or other people of that power are going to put deadly things in that which is supposed to be for good. But that I mean they are probably going to try to get the whole world sick with a virus that cannot be defended against by human body born after the year 1968. Good point. Bill Sardi has a good article on his website, billsardi.com. I guess actually the website's Knowledge of Health, something like that. But just type in billsardi.com and it'll take you right to it. He has a good article about a pig in Korea that has a human virus in it that apparently this is being manipulated possibly to become another epidemic or plague to lower human population. There certainly are some evil people out there who would like to lower human population. We cover that on video number one. So interesting. She makes me shiver. If you have more information on that 1950s virus, I have not seen the news about that. Sorry about that. I travel a lot. Okay. And let's see. England, Canada, 999. Right. Just a thought. If the bacteria was able to all of a sudden eat in a new environment, maybe it always had the ability, and now that it is put in the environment, we're able to see that it can survive there. Does that make sense? It does. The problem is the bacteria in the old environment with the glucose, when put in the environment, in the new environment, most will starve or will die. A few survive. Just like roaches, okay, when you spray pesticides on roaches and 99% of them die, the 1% that survives had a mutation to keep it, you know, roach pesticide resistant or something. That's not new information. It already had that information. Very interesting, John. You know, the guys were trying to, years ago, they were trying to find the Northwest Passage. They were going to see, is there a way around North America by going north up through Canada? Is there?
This is the penicillin thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, they got into Hudson Bay, if I recall the story, and couldn't figure out a way out of there, and ended up, there is no Northwest Passage unless you go way north, and they froze, okay? Or they died. They dug these guys up, autopsied them here about 10 years ago, if I recall the story, and they found out some of them had a resistance to penicillin, which penicillin hadn't been invented yet. So how could they be resistant to something that's not even created yet? Fascinating. Proving what we've been saying all along, Jonathan. That proves dinosaurs lived with man, doesn't it? I'm making that part up. There we go. They did, by the way. Okay, Monkey88 writes in, the caller Jared was asking you about the fall of man. Could you please explain your perception of this event and maybe provide some Bible verses to back up your perception? What is that one, Jonathan, about the fall of man?
He was talking about, you know, why do we have, I guess, the broken cytochrome C? Or, you know, I guess, why can't we produce vitamin C, I mean?
Well, why did my old van, the heater quit working, the air conditioner quit working, the taillight on one side quit working? Does that prove General Motors didn't build it? Or does that prove it's getting old and worn out?
He had a weird idea yesterday. He was saying, you know, because we have all these problems, it's kind of like a parent slashing a child in the back. So it's kind of God beating up on us or something, you know, claiming that these mutations and these detriments that are, you know, kind of litter our genomes are from God directly and that he's trying to slash us around. So I don't know where he got that idea.
Well, no, me neither. Most of the things happening in the world we're doing to ourselves.
It's just like General Motors made your van, and when they did it, it was working great. And then they put it into your care.
And I broke it.
Yeah, it breaks.
I wore it out. Not their fault.
If they wanted to, they could continue to maintain that thing, keep it going, you know, but that's not, they gave it to, you know, they entrusted it to somebody else, which is what God did with us. He gave us his creation, his earth, and we ruined it.
Well, we drove it to South Dakota, one of the first meetings I ever had in full-time evangelism, to the church of, you know, 38 people. And it was cold, 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 and the heater didn't work. A lot of things didn't work on it. It had 250,000 miles on it. I had been nursing it along. My dad bought it brand new, sold it to me for a dollar. I drove it long, long time. And we got to looking at it, made a list of everything wrong with it. And we decided if we put about $6,000 into the van, it would be worth about $500 when we got done.
I can relate.
You can relate. Okay.
Yeah.
So at some point, you got to make a decision and say, hold it, stop the music. Let's go dig a big hole and use it for landfill, okay? And that's what we did. Well, we didn't dig the hole, but use it for landfill. But we sold it for $10 to a junkyard or $20 or whatever it was. Bottom line is we got a different one. So the fact that something doesn't work anymore, I don't see how that comes in as evidence for evolution. Is that what he was saying, that we have things that are broken, we can't make...
I think this was kind of his argument against the existence of God. You know, why doesn't God let us control our own metabolism? You know, why do we have all these bad things about us? Why can't we produce vitamin C?
Well, why doesn't it let us control our own growth? Why can't you just decide to grow taller?
That'd actually be kind of cool. You know, I mean, basketball, I don't know, because they'd keep going and going.
Yeah, I mean, this is the genie syndrome, you know. I want to be the greatest, strongest genie in the world, you know.
Well, whenever they get down to why doesn't God let us do this, why doesn't God, you know, why didn't God put an armor plate, self-retracting helmet around our head for whenever we ride motorcycles that just kind of shoots out whenever we're flying through the air and then goes back in whenever we're walking, it becomes a really desperate cry for help because they don't have any real evidence against God, so they have to make up these hypothetical why not to, you know, argue against God. Why didn't God give us rocket boosters in our butt to make us, you know, fly to work faster or something like that?
Well, I think I got it figured out. What they're wanting to say is, why didn't God make us God?
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Why can't we control our own, why can't we grow extra arms out of our back? And like that six-legged calf, you know. You tip it over, it keeps running. That's going to be incredible.
Either that or when you jump up to get on it, it'll kick you in the head.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, folks, get your questions in here. Dr. Dino Live, DrDinoLive, or call us at 850-479-3466. 850-479-3466. Here's an article somebody sent me. Can a Christian believe in evolution? From Idea. Is this Idea Magazine?
No idea. I haven't seen it.
May, June of 2005, page 30. It's a photocopy of a page. But it's pretty hard to read. I think it is called Idea Magazine. Question. The big question, it says. In our series exploring frequently asked questions about the Christian faith, Dennis Alexander, a fellow of St. Edmund's College and editor of Science and Christian Belief, examines the question, can a Christian believe in evolution? Perhaps you should start by defining the term evolution. Charles Darwin published Origin of Species in 1859, as a theory to explain the origins of biological diversity. At that time, that's all it was, a biological theory, that Christians were, in fact, quick to declare as a biblical doctrine of creation. Now, this author's right, Jonathan. It was the Christians who accepted evolution first, and that was a dumb, dumb mistake. Okay,
kind of like today, they teach the Big Bang Theory in schools, and there are many Christians, it amazes me, they have bumper stickers. It says, the Big Bang, God said it, boom, it happened. And a lot of people really think that the Big Bang is how God created the universe, when it's completely opposite of how God actually did it, as revealed in His Word.
Well, there's going to be a Big Bang. You know, it's going to end with one.
Yeah.
But it didn't start with one. I tell people, you better get ready for the Big Bang. It's coming soon to a city near you. Okay. The article goes on to say, Asa Gray, professor of natural history at Harvard and a committed Christian, had long been Darwin's confidant and organized the publication of The Origin of Species in North America. Christians such as Gray maintained that God had providentially arranged the biological process of evolution to bring about God's purpose in creation. B.B. Warfield, the Princeton theologian and prominent defender of the inspiration of Scripture, spoke of himself as a Darwinian in the purest water. The British historian James Moore writes that, with but few exceptions, the leading Christian thinkers in Great Britain and America came to terms quite readily with Darwinism and evolution. And the American sociologist George Marsden reports that, with the exception of Harvard's Louis Agassiz, virtually every American Protestant zoologist and botanist accepted some form of evolution by the early 1870s. So given this initially warm reception, why did hostility toward evolution in Christians gain such prominence in the U.S. late a century later, even giving rise to textbook battles? Well, we'll be back in a second, folks, and finish this article. Get your question in to Dr. Dino Live, D-R-D-I-N-O-L-I-V-E. We'll be back. AOL Instant Messenger.
If you're like me, you believe the FBI has never apologized, never had any thoughts of regret about Ruby Ridge. Well, here's FBI negotiator Fred Lansley. Hear what he says.
We fouled up in front of the entire world, and it should never have happened. And I think it was just a really disappointing day for the FBI.
The FBI later admits to covering up facts during the court case, and the rules of engagement are deemed unconstitutional.
Well, the FBI may not have officially apologized for what went on at Ruby Ridge, but it was impressive to hear Fred Lansley speak out against his bosses. That's almost never done. This DVD, new to me, is really great. Lots of good background information about the Weaver case, and Randy himself showing up and telling his story. You can have a copy if you write to me, P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444.
Hi, I'm Lee Strobel, author of The Case for a Creator. As you know, evolution and naturalism are taught in public schools as scientific truth. But in my new book, The Case for a Creator, I reveal the evidence from science that clearly indicates God is the architect of the universe and the author of life. I've explored six different scientific disciplines and asked key experts for the latest data. Wherever I look, the latest evidence points straight toward God as our creator. Consider the evidence from astronomy. Everything about the Earth, from its position in the universe to its complex geological and chemical processes, work together with perfect efficiency to create a safe place for humans to live. Astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez and science philosopher J. Wesley Richards said it would take a star with the highly unusual properties of our sun to nurture living organisms on a circling planet. Numerous factors, such as the right mass, the right light, the right distance, the right orbit, and the right galaxy, make our solar system and our location in the universe ideal for a habitable environment. Harvard-educated astrophysicist John O'Keefe of NASA said if the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could never have come into existence. He believed that these circumstances indicate that the universe was created for man to live in. As you can see, there's plenty of new scientific evidence that affirms the universe was created by God. This alone is reason to celebrate, but we must continue to build and share this new knowledge. Read The Case for a Creator or visit caseforacreator.com and prepare yourself for meaningful discussions about intelligent design. And if you think this evidence from astronomy was compelling, you should hear the proof from biochemistry.
All right, folks, welcome back to the final segment of the Creation Science Hour and a Half. This is Ken Hovind and Jonathan Sampson, June 9, 2005. You're welcome to be on the program, 850-479-3466, extension 136. Once again, 850-479-3466, extension 136. The book that was advertised by Lee Strobel, Lee Strobel has a lot of good ideas in his books. However, he is an old Earth creationist. He believes the Earth is billions of years old and God used the Big Bang to get us here. I strongly disagree. I don't want to disparage any advertisers on the program, but I just want to point out I would strongly disagree. God doesn't need evolution. The Big Bang Theory is a big dud. There's no evidence for evolution anyway. So why are these guys trying to compromise a perfectly good Bible with a dumb theory that has no evidence for it? All right, Jonathan, who's on the phone?
We've got Jared on the phone.
Jared, back from Sweden? No, this is...
No, that's Martin from Sweden.
Martin
from
Sweden.
Minnesota?
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Granite State. Go ahead, Jared.
Yeah, I took your bait, gentlemen. You were obviously baiting me to get back on the program. So let's talk about vitamin C again. Now, I looked this up, and the gene is actually called L-guanogamma-lactone oxidase, right?
I don't recall, but I believe that's correct.
Okay. This gene is in common between guinea pigs and humans. Is that what you were thinking of when you said hamsters, Jonathan?
What's that?
I'm reading a paper that's talking about it being in common between humans and guinea pigs. Is that what
is
you were thinking
of? Is this Wesley Ellsbury's paper?
I'm not sure who wrote it.
Okay, well, go ahead anyway.
It's just an excerpt. I mean, I can give the reference if you want later, but... Anyway, what they're saying is, it's in common between humans and guinea pigs, but it's not broken in the same way between humans and guinea pigs. The real point about vitamin C, this gene, is that it's exactly the same between chimps and humans. And if you go down the phylogenetic tree of our closest relatives, like the gorillas, the macaques, you start seeing mutations in that gene at exactly the expected mutation rates from the evolutionary theory.
Well, that's proof. We all came from a rock.
No, Kent, it's not. But are you admitting that you were wrong before about this?
You think that's an indication of common ancestry. Is that what you're
Absolutely.
Saying?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, first place, I think you need to understand, the human genome has a very small amount of it has even been analyzed, okay? Number two,
this has been analyzed.
What's that?
Yeah, but this has been analyzed.
Okay, if you look at the way they determine the similarities, it's usually the melting point. As they heat up the DNA, and notice what temperature it melts at.
No, when they compare specific genes like this, they actually list out the gene.
How do they know? They can't even see those genes with a microscope.
Actually, that's not true, but that's not how they do it anyway. They actually sequence it.
How do they sequence it? And the chimpanzee...
I've read about these sequencing machines before. You can pull specific parts of DNA into a computer.
Through the USB port?
Maybe at some point.
That'd be cool, man.
I mean, we're literally talking about data. These are bits of data. In fact, it's nibbles because it's ATGC. So
I know.
Bits.
Isn't it critical? Isn't it amazing how complex these things are?
Yeah,
we
evolution
have
is amazing.
A 2-bit code for the, off and on for the our computers. This is a 4-bit code.
I know. Yeah.
You'd almost
cool.
think
let's stay on topic, though, okay?
Okay, but you'd think there was a designer if you didn't know better, wouldn't you?
No, I wouldn't think there's a designer because I want to ask the designer why exactly there are broken parts in different species in exactly the same way.
Well, no, that's a good question. But I don't think that's evidence for evolution. And why? I think you're desperate for evidence for your theory is the problem.
It's evidence for common ancestry.
Well, to you it is.
Why is it not evidence for common ancestry to you, if it's not just you being blinded by your own theory?
Okay, our golf cart ran over a nail. The front left tire was flat. The neighbor's car across the street was a Ford, and it had a front left tire that went flat.
We're not talking about machines.
They both have the same broken tire. This is proof that
they both
came from a skateboard. I'm telling you, the kid rides a skateboard around here, and I know it evolved into that Volkswagen.
Oh, my gosh. It's like if you found two blueprints. For two different types of go-karts, and they were 98% identical blueprints, and then you found the flaw at the same exact part of the blueprint. That's a lot closer to what we're talking about. But even then, I would probably object to the analogy because, you know, go-karts don't self-reproduce.
And who made the blueprint? The designer designed the blueprint.
That's what we're arguing about. But, I mean, I want you to just stop using those analogies because they're fallacious.
Okay. Are you saying, could it be that the designer... designed the human DNA and the chimpanzee DNA.
Sure, I entertain the possibility. I'm just telling you that the evidence is pointing against it.
They both broke at the same place.
Yeah, so tell me, I want you to explain to me, if the fall of man is what caused this, was there a fall of apes?
Well, the Bible says in Romans chapter 8, the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain. There's suffering in the whole creation. Yes, Adam's fall affected the entire creation. Lambs had to die for them to be clothed.
Fine, but explain to me why exactly chimps and humans have exactly the same broken gene.
Okay, first of all, I don't know that they do. I'm taking your word on this.
This is fact, Kent. This is scientific fact, and you can go look it up yourself.
I will, but first of all, I'm still going to question that strongly, because I don't think man knows as much about the DNA as you think he does.
I think that the genetics is in its infancy, but I don't think that we're just shooting in the dark here. We're looking at actual specific pieces of data.
Okay. If you put a 5-year-old under the hood of your car and say, take out whatever it doesn't need, he's going to take it all out. Okay. He doesn't know what it needs. It's a lack of his understanding. What on earth is this, you know, EGR valve? I don't know. Pull it out. You know, what's a spark plug for?
I don't know. See what your analogy has to do with anything. We're talking about sophisticated equipment that they can.
I'm trying to point out to you that you have this grandiose idea that modern man is so smart and knows everything about the DNA, and we don't.
No, I didn't say knows everything about the DNA. I'm saying that we have sequencing equipment that can pull in the DNA into a computer and look at it on a screen.
Well, you know how computers are. Garbage in, garbage out.
Come on, Ken. Is this really your excuse for doctoring this point?
I'm telling you that you need to stop and smell the coffee. Man does not know as much as you think he knows about the DNA code.
What you're saying, basically, is that whenever we... See, what you're doing here is you're scared, and you realize that there is strong evidence against your point.
Oh, I'm not
either. And all you're doing is denying the people who have the evidence.
No.
And you're saying, if this evidence is here, well, I'm just going to question it and just blow it off.
I'm doing what any scientist should do. When somebody says, hey, here's my evidence, I'm saying, wait. Have you looked at this from all sides?
Healthy skepticism is a very good
thing. That's what
I've got. I think that your level of skepticism is healthy.
Because it goes against your theory?
No, because you are just denying anything that remotely goes against what you think. You don't even want to go look at it.
You have taken this little bit of evidence that two creatures have the same broken gene and jumped on that and said,
just two creatures. We're talking about the entire phylogenetic tree of primates.
But let's say all the primates have the same broken gene.
They don't.
Okay. First of all, they have
this broken gene, but it's broken in different ways. The mutation rate matches the mutations that are found in the genomes of these different creatures.
But listen. The gene code is so incredibly complex. Chromosome 14 has 87 million base pairs.
What's your point?
It is so complex that I don't think modern man understands near what you think he understands about the gene code, number one. Number two, I don't think that enough research has been done to prove what you're saying is correct, because what you're doing is taking recent research on broken chromosomes, broken genes.
This is 10 years old, at least, actually.
But if you look at the history of this evolutionary theory, all the evidence that comes up and everybody jumps on it and says, oh, wow, Piltdown Man, and they keep it in the books for 40 years later.
Oh, come on.
Later it's proven wrong.
Piltdown Man, come on.
What evidence do you have that has stood the test of time? This evidence has not stood the test of time yet.
Oh.
The theory's been out 160 years.
No, genetics has not been out for 160 years.
No, but the theory of evolution has.
Darwin didn't even have, he didn't even know about Gregor Mendel, for God's sake. I mean...
Oh, he should have, and he never would have got this dumb theory out there.
Oh, he would have been so much stronger in his theory, because he would have been refined at the time instead of, like, the neo-Darwinists having to come back later and change it. That's why a lot of people criticize Darwin. Like, creationists say, oh, Darwin is falsified because he didn't know how characters were, you know, blended in the genes instead of blended by characters and blah, blah, blah. I mean, come on. It would have made it a stronger...
Okay, let me finish my point. Number one, we don't know as much as we think we know about the DNA. Number two, as much as you think the scientists know about the DNA. Number two, the chimpanzee DNA has been very sparsely even examined.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So here you are, assuming that there's a common ancestry based on when one side of the equation has been barely touched.
No,
I think you're jumping at a conclusion because you are anxious to come to that conclusion.
The thing is, if you go and you... Oh, my God. Don't you see the problem with this?
Yes, I'm trying to see your problem.
If you went and sequenced like turtles and rats and lizards and fish, you're not going to get the same structure of the vitamin C synthesizing gene. You're not going to see the same pattern. That's why it supports common ancestry for primates.
That's where this is your interpretation of it.
No, this is not interpretation.
This is where my golf cart analogy is perfect.
No, it's not. They don't reproduce.
Well, they both had a flat tire on the front left.
They don't reproduce, Kent. You're using a fallacious analogy. Please stop it.
How on earth can I get you to see that this little tiny scrap of evidence that you are grasping at is so minor in the big picture, when just one chromosome on chromosome 14 on humans has 87 million base pairs?
What does that have to do with anything?
Well, I'm just trying to explain to you. We got 46 chromosomes. The complexity of the human gene code is staggering. Absolutely staggering.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome to behold, but I don't see what that has to do with vitamin C.
Well, let's just take an analogy and say I'm looking through a book and find on page 5, line 3, there's a typo. I look through a different unrelated book and find on page 3, line 5, there's a typo.
That's the thing, though. Chimpanzee DNA in human DNA is not like an unrelated book in your analogy. That's a bad analogy.
Okay.
We know exactly... we can look at the DNA between chimps and humans and see what the connection is. Chromosomes have been fused together.
Okay, you keep saying we, like you're one of these scientists
in the scientific community. I'm saying as a human, you know, scientific enterprise. Whatever,
okay.
Scientists.
All right. So my point is, number one, we don't know as much as you think we know about the DNA. Number two, if there are broken, I want to question, I mean, as any lawyer would, I would question your evidence. I want to have this proven.
I want you to question the evidence.
Good.
I want you to go out and read
okay.
this.
Number
and
three.
And I'll have an even more solid point.
Number three, even if the evidence turns out to be exactly what you say, that they both have the chromosome, cytochrome C chromosome broken.
No, it's not cytochrome C, it's a whole other
okay.
gene.
Okay, I'm sorry. They have the vitamin C chromosome gene broken in exactly the same place. That still does not prove common ancestry.
Does it give evidence for common ancestry?
You could interpret it as that. I could interpret it as evidence for a common creator or creatures living in a common environment, and the same environment causes the same damage.
So it's not the fall of man?
Well, I don't know. We do live in a fallen environment.
I want you to explain to me how the fall of man explains this. How does the fall of man explain why L-gulino gamma-lactone oxidase is broken in precisely the same way between chimps and humans, and that the mutations that show up when you go further back on the tree, like with gorillas and macaques, matches the mutation rates?
Here you have your theory guiding your research.
Well, of course, because until you falsify it, that's what you do in science.
So you assume evolution has happened. You take the theory as being true, and you interpret your data to fit your theory.
Kent, this is like an astronomer looking out at the stars, and then somebody comes up and says, I don't believe in stars.
All right. Okay.
And they're like,
up.
Well,
okay.
You're just using your star theory to interpret what you see in the sky.
Okay.
The same
hey,
thing.
Call in tomorrow. My time is up. We've got 1 minute left, and I've got to get some closing comments for some of these other folks. But I would say, as an attorney, if I was taking this as a case, you would not have won the case. There are too many gaping loopholes in this thing, but I will research that more. All right, folks. Program here, 850-479-DINO, extension 136. Jonathan, where's that article? I never did finish that. Can a Christian believe in evolution? Are we going to have time to finish that? Probably not.
Got a couple
okay.
more minutes.
Oh, 2 minutes. I got 2 minutes on my watch. Here we go. This article from IDEA, page 30, I think it's May, June 2005, if I can read it on this faxed copy to me, which is pretty poor, says that there were people who fought against, Christians accepted evolution when the theory first came out, which is correct, and a mistake, by the way. And now Christians are fighting against evolution. That's correct, and that's the right way to do it. Herbert Spencer, 1820 to 1903, was a great popularizer of evolution. Answer the question to the article, I don't think you can be a good Christian and believe in evolution. And you better define what you mean by evolution. You better define what you mean by Christian. I doubt both of that. All right, we'll be back tomorrow, folks. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
I'm excited about a new resource just made available to Truth Radio. A friend of Truth Radio has sent us a quantity of a booklet entitled Our American Common Law. If you've wondered what the difference is between common law, equity law, and contract law, all these very important distinctions, and how the gold or money issue enters into this whole discussion, this booklet is for you, and we have enough copies, so I'm sure we can send you one. This is just under 30 pages, and it's yours entirely free of charge in return for your contribution of any size to Truth Radio. We need your support. Our address is Post Office Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444. Ask for the booklet entitled Common Law.
Well, if you feel that way about her, why don't you ask her out?
I don't know. I doubt she'd say yes.
How are you going to find out if you don't ask?
Some things we doubt are worth finding out.
Yeah, I heard about the opening, and I'd like to interview, but I just don't think I'd get the job.
Bob, you're the best person for that job. You should go for it.
Oh, I doubt they'd even consider me.
But you won't know that unless you interview.
Doubt should motivate us to pursue an answer.
Oh, I doubt it's cancer. I'm sure it's nothing. Barb, it's a lump. You need to find out for sure. I doubt they'll find anything.
Are you someone who doubts that God exists?
Frank, do you believe there's a God?
Well, I don't know. Personally, I doubt it.
The question of whether God exists is an important one. Don't base your beliefs on your doubts. Turn your doubts into questions and start asking them. The Bible has a lot to say about God. Be passionate about finding the answer. A message from Lifeline Productions. 1-800-523-8669. LifelinePro.com.